Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for October's Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I'm very pleased to welcome to Webinar Club our speaker for today, European recognised specialist in veterinary ophthalmology, Claudia Roos. Thank you, Claudia. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Welcome to our webinar on lens diseases in dogs. I've chosen the title of this webinar because lens diseases are actually fairly common, so everybody working in small animal practice will actually see some patients, some dogs with lens diseases throughout their career. And unfortunately, these lens diseases are often underestimated and sometimes referred quite late, which then limits the treatment options as well as the success for the patients. So I thought to take the opportunity to look at different lens diseases in dogs. Throughout the talk, I would say if you do have any questions, ask them straight away or make a note of them, and we'll have hopefully a little bit of time at the end to answer the question. In the webinar, we're just initially going to start with some essential basics about the lens. So we're going to look at its development, anatomy, and physiology just to understand how the lens works and why certain conditions of the lens may cause so severe problems inside the eye. And then we're going to look at the specific diseases with main focus on the three most common conditions that we see in the lens, including lens trauma, cataract, and lens luxation. So let's just start with the general anatomy of the eye. So we'll just start, if we just look at the outer coat of the eye, consisting in the anterior part of the transparent cornea and in the posterior segment, the white fibrous sclera. And the next inner layer is the vascular layer or uvea, consisting of the iris, the ciliary body, and the choroid at the posterior wall of the eye. And then there's the neurosensory retina, which will be sitting just on top of the uvea. It's not drawn into this graphic picture of the eye, but just that's where it would be positioned. So the lens is this lentil-shaped structure, transparent, right behind the iris, and it is held in place by these zonules that we will look at a little bit later in more detail. So when we talk about the lens, it's important that we use the same terminology. That is important when you, for example, want to describe where a lens lesion might be, for example, a cataract. So just think of the lens like a globe, like the globe of the world. So we have a pole we've got just in the lens. There's an anterior pole and a posterior pole. And then the outline of the lens in the periphery we call the equator. So a cataract may, for example, affect just the posterior pole of the lens, or there might be vacuoles or early signs of cataract in the equator of the lens, which then will obviously have a very limited impact of the vision of the patient. But it's still important to localize these lesions. So the development of the lens is very interesting. It originates from the surface ectoderm, so that's the same tissue that gives origin to the eyelids as well as the cornea. And the lens develops by the surface ectoderm invaginating and eventually forming a lens vesicle. And there's a single layer of cuboidal cells, and the lens has got a basement membrane on the outside due to this invagination process. Now, initially, we've got a fluid-filled cavity there in the center, as you can see here. But what happens then is that the lens or the cells in the posterior part of this vesicle, they start to elongate and fill this cavity. And that's what we call the primary lens fibers. And the whole thing then forms the embryonic nucleus of the lens. Okay, so here we've got another picture that's demonstrating this really nicely. You can see how these cells elongate and start to fill this cavity, forming the nucleus. Now, that's not the end of the lens development. We've still got an active epithelial layer at the front here. So these cells, they will continue to produce lens fibers throughout life. And they do that at the area of the equator. So remember, so this is this part of the lens where there are constantly new lens fibers formed throughout life. A little bit like an onion, these layers are put around that initial central nucleus. And the reason of this continuous production of lens fibers is this continuous production of lens fibers is the cause for the lens thickening and becoming denser throughout life. So it becomes less elastic and it also starts to develop nuclear sclerosis as a normal aging process. But again, we'll have a look at that a little bit later. So important is to remember here that the oldest part of the lens is in the center, then that newly formed fibers are in the periphery of the lens. So again, you can see the lens fibers here in this embryonic nucleus. And this is what's this area in the equator is what remains mitotically active. Okay, so therefore, the anatomy of the lens consists of a lens capsule. So remember, because of the indentation process of this lens vesicle, the lens capsule is an epithelium and is actually on the outside of this tissue. Yeah, it is thicker in the front because we'll keep a mitotically active epithelium in that area. So this basement membrane or capsule is produced throughout life, therefore making it thicker. In the posterior segment, we do not aspect of the lens, we do not have this active epithelium, and the lens capsule remains very thin. Then the inner part of the lens is also divided into the lens nucleus. Remember, that was embryologically developed in a different way from these so-called cortex. That is that comes from the new fibers that are being formed throughout life. So therefore, the relation of the cortex to the nucleus changes with the cortex increasing over time. And here, there's onions that I've already mentioned before. So they are small fibers that connect the periphery of the lens. So this structure is actually the lens. And you can see the zonulus connecting the lens with the ciliary body. So the lines that you can see here are the pars, is the pars plicata of the ciliary body, and that's where the lens is connected to and held in place. Now, what you've already noticed, and what is a really important point, is that the lens lacks any vascularization. So for all its metabolic needs, it totally relies on the aqueous humor, so the fluid that fills the anterior chamber of the eye, as well as the posterior chamber. So this is the anterior chamber of the eye, the posterior chamber just here behind the iris, yeah, as well as the vitreous. So that's the jelly-like substance filling the posterior segment of the eye. So important is that any change in either of these structures, let's say an inflammation, for example, will have an impact on the metabolism of the lens and may therefore cause diseases of the lens, such as a cataract. Now, it's also important that as the lens separates from the rest of the body during the very early stage of the development, it is that the lens protein gets shielded by that lens capsule from the body, and the body does not learn to recognize lens protein as belonging to the body, as being tolerant to it. So if lens protein gets exposed, the eye will actually react to that quite dramatically, and that's called a lens-induced uveitis. So what does the lens do? We all know that the lens has got a refractive power, so it allows the eye to focus, and it also allows the eye to focus on things at different distances, which is accommodation. Now, the accommodation range of a dog is actually far less than that of a person, and the dog is only 1 to 3 diopters. So we want to examine the lens, then remember that the lens is sitting behind the iris, so it's largely obscured by the iris, and if we do want to examine this, we should dilate the pupil. Further examination techniques or the examination techniques then used to examine the lens, ideally you want to use a slit lamp, and I will show you why. Really allows nicely to examine the whole lens and also to localize the lesions within that lens. On the other hand, a direct or indirect ophthalmoscope can also be very useful to examine the lens for any opacities or for its position. Other techniques used to examine the lens include retroillumination illumination and the effect of parallax. So just a little note to say, do remember to dilate the pupil because any smaller lesions, such as here, small peripheral cataract, may be missed otherwise. So what do we use when we dilate the pupil? A common answer to this is atropine. So atropine is still used by many colleagues to dilate the pupil. We would not recommend that. We would recommend the use of tropicamide. They're both parasympatholytic drugs. However, the tropicamide has got the advantage of a faster onset of only 20 to 30 minutes. And the effect only lasts for 3 to 4 hours. On the other hand, atropine, the onset takes a little bit longer, so roughly 1 hour, but it can last up to 7 to 10 days, and gets sometimes even longer than that. So it is really having a patient with dilated pupils for several days can actually be quite uncomfortable. In addition to that, unfortunately, the atropine also reduces the tear production, so it can cause dry eye, even if only just for a limited period of time, usually. But it's something to think about, and you may have to substitute false tears in these patients. But atropine may also increase the intraocular pressure, which is particularly a concern in patients that either have glaucoma or are at risk to develop glaucoma. In our practice, we do use the tropicamide minims, and also minims for other drugs here. It's got the big advantage if you don't see, first of all, they're sterile drops, and you can use a small amount rather than having an open bottle standing around for several days or weeks. That may potentially lead to contamination of the eye drops. So the single-use drops are really good. Particularly if you don't see as many eye patients, you can just open one for the individual case that you see. This is an image of a slit lamp examination. So when you use a slit, there's a very light, a very thin beam of light shown onto the eye, and that light is reflected in different layers inside the eye. So the first layer the light is reflected on and becomes visible is the cornea. So this is the first layer here. This is our cornea. Then the next time the light is reflected is the anterior lens capsule. So that will be this beam here. Yeah, and you can see that this continues into the iris. So the pupil is dilated here. We've got the anterior lens capsule and the surface of the iris. Then another layer is the posterior lens capsule. You can see that here, different direction of this reflected light. And what we can see in this lens, this is an older patient. We've also got a ring that's outlining the nucleus. So as you can already see, this gives us a really nice three-dimensional impression of the lens, so that we can localize lesions, so we can tell whether a lesion is in the front or in the back, for example. So this patient's got a very fine nuclear cataract here, so you can see a few specks of we call them fiberglass cataracts in this area here. Now looking at the patient on the other side, again we've got a light beam here that represents the cornea, and then a light beam on the anterior lens capsule. And the one in the posterior lens capsule is not that easy to see because there is a cataract in this patient that, as you can see, is pretty much filling the whole center of the lens. It's mainly nuclear, but it's also extending into the anterior and posterior segment of the lens. And what is noticeable is that that lens is much, so the anterior posterior diameter of that lens is much shorter, indicating that this lens is smaller, microphthalmic. So we're looking at retroillumination. How does that help us? So retroillumination is a technique where we use the tapetum that we find in most of our patients and most dogs. The tapetum, a reflective layer behind the retina within the choroid. And what happens is we'll shine light into the eye, and that light is reflected back. However, any opacity on the way, be it within the vitreous, within the lens, or anterior segment, will block that light, and during our examination appears a dark shadow. So that's very highly sensitive technique to see any opacities within the lens. Okay, so that's what it would look like for that little lesion that we've seen before. So again, a small peripheral cataract in retroillumination will appear as a gray and dark spot because it bleaches or it blends out the light. And the effect of parallax is a technique that you can use to try and localize a lesion within the lens, so to be able to say whether the anterior or posterior segment of the lens is affected. And that's if you move relatively, or if you move to the lens, and we'll just think of the black squares being the center of the lens. Everything that is in front will move away from you, and everything that is behind will move with you, and you move from left to right in front of that eye. So that'll help you, give you a little bit of an idea where relatively to the lens nucleus the lesion is positioned. That'll be much easier to see obviously with a slit lamp, but if that's not available, that's still a very useful technique to use. Okay, so we're moving on from our examination techniques to the actual diseases of the lens. So we'll start off with a list of eye or lens diseases that may actually occur. So we're looking at congenital abnormalities. There may be an aphakia, so it's a very rare absence of a lens, so lenses never developed. There might be microphakia, so that's just the presence of a very small lens. And there might be a lens coloboma, normally an area where there's no zonules holding the lens in place, so it really looks like there's a part of the lens missing. And if we're looking at this patient here, you can see the lens, there's a cataract there, this white opacity, and we're just following the pupil margin here. And here in the top, we can all of a sudden start to see the edge of the lens. So it's a little bit shiny, and then it goes all the way around. And you can see the lens margin here. Yeah, so there seems to be a piece of the lens missing. And often in this area, also the little zonules that keep the lens in place are also absent. Other congenital abnormalities of the lens may include a lenticonus or lentiglobus. These conditions describe different shape of the posterior pole of the lens, maybe either cone-shaped or overly round. Cataracts may be congenital and much rarer than the above conditions. There may also be a congenital lens luxation that is normally associated with other abnormalities or multiple ocular defects. Again, most of these conditions are fairly rare, and out of these we will focus on the cataracts in a little bit. So then there are also obviously acquired abnormalities of the lens, and then including trauma, cataract that may be hereditary or non-hereditary, and lens instability, so a luxation or subluxation of the lens. So I just got a question on why the body does not tolerate the lens protein and why we develop a lens-induced uveitis. So try to explain that. So the lens separates from the body very early in the first few days of development and is surrounded by a capsule. So that protein, as it then develops, develops in different ways. So there will be different antigens that these proteins have compared to other proteins in the body. And the immune system is not exposed to this protein, so the developing immune system does not learn to recognize that protein as being part of the body. So this different development that starts so early doesn't allow the body to get used to that. And therefore, if lens protein gets then exposed to the body at a later stage, the immune system fights it as if it was a foreign body. I hope that makes sense. Okay. So that's that the trauma of the lens that we're looking at now as the first of the conditions is one of the reasons why it is so important to know that lens protein is treated like foreign material by the eye. Because if we're looking at a trauma of the eye, so looking at things like corneal laceration or a foreign body injury or any other penetrating injury, really, it is important to assess whether that injury is only affecting the cornea, the anterior segment, or whether the lens has been involved in that process as well. So with any patient that presents with a traumatic injury to the eye, particularly if you can see that the cornea has been damaged or that there's a foreign body that might be extending into the eye, it's essential to find out whether the lens has also been affected by that trauma. Sometimes foreign bodies may just go in and come out again. They may not be visible anymore. So it's always important to dilate the pupil in these patients. Now, again, you can use tropicamide here. However, in an inflamed eye, that may not be strong enough. And sometimes it is necessary to use atropine eye drops to dilate the pupil. And be aware that the pupil will be hopefully dilated for a few days. But it is something that you will want in an inflamed eye to prevent adhesions. Now, if a lens injury cannot be ruled out or is expected, then would strongly recommend referral of the patient. And if we cannot assess the inside of the eye, so if you looking at this patient here, a patient with severe corneal edema that doesn't allow the assessment of the intraocular structures, and then it's recommended to do an ocular ultrasound to see if a lens injury can be confirmed or ruled out. So the management of a potential lens injury depends very much on the extent of the lesion. So if the lesion is only very small, so only a couple of millimeter, that may be may possible to manage that conservatively. So just with anti-inflammatory medication. So we'll be looking at topical steroid eye drops and systemic non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Now, it's really important to know that lens trauma, damage to the lens capsule may actually deteriorate, and patients may develop a progressing cataract that should then be operated. So only really static lesions should be managed conservatively. Now, if we miss to monitor these patients or miss to control any even very subtle intraocular inflammation, these patients are very likely going to develop long-term complications, and the main concern here is the development of secondary glaucoma. So the inflammation process causes scarring, causes changes within the draining structure of the eye, and will then fail to work, and the pressure in the eye will rise. And these eyes are very rarely responding to topical glaucoma medication, so are often lost to the disease. Now, if there's a progressing cataract, then again, removal of the cataract will be required to keep the eye visual. And it is important that these lens injuries, so if we're just looking at this here, this is a lens injury, there's some pigment on the anterior lens capsule and the cataract associated with that. It's very small. However, it remains a weak spot, damage to that lens capsule, and potentially that cataract can progress rapidly months, even years later after the injury. So it's really important to discuss that with the owner. So if anything happens to that eye, that they really seek immediate immediate advice and see their ophthalmologist. So here's a patient with a very subtle lens injury. So what you can see here, this is a corneal wound that's fibrosed, so it's largely healed by now. And we've had a foreign body that's gone down and hit the anterior lens capsule in this area. So there's some pigment on the surface, because quite often these patients, they pupil constricts, and the iris lays itself onto that defect and can obscure it very well, and some pigment may just adhere to the area. So this patient has not developed a progressing cataract and is being managed conservatively. Now, if we do have larger lesions of the lens capsule, sometimes lens material even gets starts to protrude into the anterior chamber, patients develop a fairly significant intraocular inflammation or lens-induced uveitis. And that really, if that happens, surgical removal of the lens should be recommended as quickly as possible. The reason being is that the lens-induced uveitis can actually damage the eye severely and making cataract surgery impossible. So if we're looking at this patient here, there was a foreign body injury in the area. The foreign body had been removed, but the lens injury had not been noticed at the initial consultation. And the patient developed within 3 or 4 days severe inflammation, corneal edema, and secondary glaucoma, and the eye was lost. I'll just show you, this is an ultrasound image of the same eye. So this is the outline of the globe here. This is where normally the cataract sits. We're going to have a look at the normal eye as well a little bit later. This is where the lens normally sits, lentil shape. What you can see is that the lens is it's got an abnormal shape and is sort of protruding into the anterior chamber. So lens material has come out and is now exposed to the eye. And in the posterior segment, we can see this linear structure here, which is the retina and indicating a retinal detachment. So very, very severe lens-induced uveitis with a rapid development of glaucoma as a possible complication. So it's strongly recommended that if there's a suspicion of a lens injury, that patients are referred immediately and, you know, within the day of the injury. So moving forward to the next condition, that would be the cataract, probably the most common lens disease that we'll see in dogs. And the cataracts really define as any opacity of the lens. There may be primary, so due to a hereditary defect, and as such can be present at birth or can develop later in life. Or there may be secondary, again caused due to trauma or infections, deficiency and so on, and may also be congenital or occur later in life depending on the underlying cause. So important is to distinguish cataracts from nuclear sclerosis. Nuclear sclerosis, I've mentioned earlier, is caused by the continuous formation of lens fibers. That means that our lens gets denser and denser and denser as we grow older. And we can start seeing nuclear sclerosis, so a grayish opacity inside the eye in dogs that reach the age of 7 or older than that. And the best way of distinguishing nuclear sclerosis from an actual cataract is retroillumination. So this is also the left eye of an, I think it's 10-year-old poodle. This is the same poodle looked at with, well, trying to use retroillumination with a camera. So what you can see is that you can line out the pupil nicely, and throughout the pupil, you can see the fundus reflex. There doesn't seem to be a clear obstruction of the light beam beam shining back at us. So there's no cataract formation here, it's just pure nuclear sclerosis. Now this usually does not interfere with vision in these patients, also does not interfere with the examination of the fundus. However, if patients get very old and really old, Yorkshire Terriers, for example, that might be, you know, 14, 15 years of old age, it may actually interfere with vision. And they may benefit from lens removal. And when we classify cataracts, we'll do that based on the degree of maturity or how much of the lens is actually affected by the cataract. Cataract may be incipient, which means that less than 10 or 15% of the lens is affected, which is the case in the image on top here. So we've just got a posterior plaque here on the posterior pole and some equatorial vesicles here that affect only a small part of the lens. Now, any lens Oh, any cataract that doesn't affect the entire lens is classified as immature. In these patients, the fundus reflex is still visible. In comparison to that, the mature cataract does not allow a fundus reflex. So just as you see at the lower image here, so the cataract is really obscuring examination of the posterior segment or the light being shown back from the tapetum. Cataract may also become hypermature. In that case, what happens is that the lens protein, the lens, so the lens molecules are starting to get lost. They may actually come through the lens capsule, and that means that the lens may shrink and the capsule may become wrinkled. But more importantly, that lens protein that then enters the eye may actually cause the lens-induced uveitis. So there will be signs of inflammation, such as the eye might be red, or there might be aqueous flares, so an increased protein content within the aqueous. So there may be clear signs of inflammation there. Let's just have a look at different classifications of cataracts, just to go through this. I've looked at this patient before, small cataract following a foreign body, penetrating foreign body, and that is an incipient cataract. So we've got a very old patient, got a nuclear cataract here, and we can still see some of the fundus reflect in the peripheries, indicating that this is an immature cataract, but it's a fairly advanced immature cataract. And then at the top here, we've got two mature cataracts. Okay, so cataracts may be congenital. I've said that before, so they might be present at birth. This may be associated with other ocular defects. Now, if you remember from the development, if a cataract is congenital, it will affect the nucleus, and therefore the most central part of the cataract. Now, these cataracts, they may not be progressive. So here we can see, would be easier to see with a slit lamp, but this round cataract is actually within the nucleus or within the center of that lens. There are some cortical extensions in the equator as well. Comparison to that, if cataracts develop late, development usually starts within the cortex, so within the outer part of the lens. And these cataracts, they are more likely to progress if they are cortical. So we're looking at primary cataracts. They are probably following the diabetic cataracts, the most common cataracts that we see in our dogs. So there tend to be breed-specific types of cataracts. For example, in the Labrador or in the Siberian Husky or in the Golden Retriever, we call posterior polar triangular cataracts. So, as the name said, the cataract classically starts in the posterior pole of the lens, this triangular structure here, again sitting at the very back. Now, these cataracts may or may not progress, and they may then start to also affect the periphery of the lens or even the entire lens. Primary cataracts may be congenital, or they may have a later onset of the condition. In comparison, that secondary cataracts are caused by usually environmental factors or systemic diseases. So we're having a we could see so there might be developmental errors. There's a number of things. There might be intoxications or viral infections and so on. Other more common causes for secondary cataracts include ocular diseases. So again, a trauma. Uveitis, as said, the lens heavily relies on the aqueous humor with regards to its metabolic needs. So if there are changes there, cataracts are very, very common. Cataracts may occur with glaucoma in a chronic disease process. They may be associated with neoplasia or retinal disease as well, such as progressive retinal atrophy may also cause cataracts. Common causes for cataracts are systemic diseases, mainly the diabetes. Other dietary deficiencies may also cause cataract formation. Now, particularly in people, external sources are more significant for cataract formation than in our canine patients. Particularly UV light is known to cause or speed the progression of cataracts and source radiation, as well as toxins. So we're looking at the most common form of metabolic cataracts that we see in practice, and everyone in small animal practice sees on a regular basis their diabetic cataracts. And it's about half of all diabetic patients that develop vision-threatening or really blinding cataracts within 6 months of being diagnosed with diabetes. So that's a high number of patients, and obviously that number increases as the disease goes on. Diabetic cataracts classically develop very rapidly, and they're caused by an altered lens metabolism. So what you can see in this drawing here is that glucose enters the lens, and due to a special metabolic pathway, that glucose is then converted into sorbitol. Sorbitol is a molecule that's very large and is not able to leave the lens through the lens capsule, so it gets trapped in there, and then it becomes osmotically active and actually sucks water into that lens, and the lens fibers then start to swell. So really the whole lens will start swelling, and there's a risk of for once lens protein coming out of that through that lens capsule into the eye, or even a rupture of the lens capsule with then severe exposure, traumatic exposure of the eye, of lens protein into the eye. So let's just look at ultrasound images of the eye. So that are the more normal images that I talked to you about before. They're not entirely normal because both patients have cataracts. So this is the outline of the globe about here. I've got the anterior chamber. With the lens, ciliary body on the side, and that's the posterior wall with the vitreous cavity. What you can see in this non-diabetic patient with cataract, that the anterior posterior lens diameter is roughly 0.7-0.5 millimeter, or centimeter rather. In this diabetic patient, however, anterior posterior diameter of the lens is nearly 1 centimeter, so this lens already very stretched. And seeing these patients, and we know that there's a high risk of this lens capsule to rupture. So these are cataract patients that we should have cataract surgery fairly urgently to prevent any further complications associated with that. So for the diabetic cataracts, it's really important. As you can imagine, cataract surgery is much, much harder if the lens capsule is ruptured. Success rate is much worse, particularly if intraocular inflammation has persisted for some time. So therefore, it is essential that diabetic patients that have developed a cataract are referred fairly early. So do not try and control the diabetes mellitus before. Now, that may be necessary still to try and stabilize the patients enough for them to have safe general anesthetic. However, it is important that they are operated early to prevent complications, such as you can see this eye here at the bottom. So we've got a ruptured lens capsule, lens material protruding into the anterior chamber, and by now there's pus and vascularization of the cornea. There's some bleeding inside the eye, and these patients, they just develop retinal detachment and glaucoma, and the eyes will not be visible, and they're not suitable for cataract surgery anymore. So if you're just looking at general complications, we just talked about the complications following diabetic cataracts, which may include the rupture of the lens capsule. Now, if you have a trauma, then that's the same thing. We've got exposure of lens protein. And apart from the development of cataracts and inflammation, these patients can develop glaucoma. If we're not sure if we've got an eye with a cataract, as you can see here with some lens-induced uveitis, so there's some pigmentary changes, then it is necessary to do an ocular ultrasound to see if any lens material is actually protruding out from that lens, and just to help us if there is lens material in the posterior segment to localize that to guide cataract surgery. So this is a patient, as you can see, he's got a cataract. in the left eye unfortunately has developed lens-induced uveitis and secondary glaucoma. So you can see that this globe is enlarged and it's a permanently blind globe due to the high intraocular pressure. So at that stage, removal of the eye becomes necessary. With these, again, patients with lens-induced uveitis, secondary glaucoma do not normally respond to the normal glaucoma medication. So when we're presented with patients with cataracts, then what we call a cataract assessment. And so what we want to know is the patient and is the eye suitable for cataract surgery? So that'll include a full medical and ophthalmic history, a physical examination. So it is important to know is the patient diabetic, that would be important for anesthetic purposes, or are there any other concurrent diseases that we have to take into consideration for the prognosis of the, for the medication that we may be able to or may not be able to give following the cataract operation. And then we do a full ophthalmic examination, see if we can find out the underlying cause of the cataract, and also if there are other abnormalities of the eye, such as dry eye, for example. So if there's a low tear production, healing of the cornea may be compromised. So it's important to rule that out or, if possible, address that before recommending cataract surgeries for the patient. And then other tests will include the ocular ultrasound. Now that is important to examine the posterior segment. Often cataracts that require cataract surgery are so dense that they do not allow the examination of the posterior segment. So by doing the ultrasounds again, as you've seen before, we can not only measure the dimension of the lens, but we can also examine the posterior segment and rule out particularly retinal detachment, as you can see in this patient here, which would mean that cataract surgery will not make this patient visual again. An ERG or electroretinogram may be possible if there are any doubts about the function of the retina, so if we cannot examine the retina and the patient may have a history of a progressive vision loss. These patients may well suffer from a progressive retinal atrophy. And an ERG will help to tell us whether the retina is working or not. So therefore, whether the patient is suitable for cataract surgery or not. So we're just going to go through some images. So try to explain to you how cataract surgery works. And what we'll do here, so what you can see here, if you've got the patient prepared for surgery, there's a speculum holding the eye open, there's a plastic drape covering the patient to provide a sterile surgical environment. So the eye is then being held with a very small pair of forceps, and this is a stab knife that is then used to create an incision. This knife has got a certain width, and that clearly defines the width of the incision into the eye. Then a blue dye may be injected into the anterior chamber of the eye and it will then be flushed out again. The aim here is to stain the anterior lens capsule to help us when we create the opening into the lens. And that process of creating the opening into the lens, as you can see here, so this is a start, what we call the capsulorhexis. So this there's a little hole created, and then with these forceps, this hole is extended into a nice round circle, as you can see here when it's finished. And that's then the opening that we're going to use for the phacoemulsification. So phacoemulsification is then a probe, you can see here, that does two things. It flushes, well, three things actually. It flushes water into the eye and sucks water as well as cataractous material out of the eye, and it vibrates at a very high frequency. So with that vibration, it really knocks that cataract material and makes it shatter into small pieces that can then be sucked out. This is a little bit further on in the operation. You can actually see that the lens material is reduced to just these few pieces of cataract being left, and they're just then removed. There's often some softer lens material in the periphery, The cortex may be a little bit softer and is then used with removed with another instrument, this so-called IA probe or irrigation aspiration probe. So it does the same thing. It sucks material and fluid out of the eye and irrigates the eye at the same time, so we have a constantly stable eye. When that is done, and we've got a nice, stable, intact lens capsule, then an intraocular lens may be injected. So again, the eye is held with a pair of forceps, and here you can see an injector that can be pushed through that small opening in our cornea. It's just a couple of millimeters, so three millimeters, 3.2 millimeters maybe, and you can see how the lens is coming out of that injector. Okay, and here the lens is unfolded now, so you can see the optic here and then the haptics that keep the lens nicely central in the patient. And then that the anterior chamber is flushed, irrigated, and then the wound is sutured close. And that's the general principle of cataract surgery. Cataract surgery is then followed by intensive medical treatment, so lots of eye drops for the owners to give for several weeks and months after the operation, usually at a reducing frequency. And it's really important that the anti-inflammatory drugs are reduced very, very slowly and really adjusted to the needs of the individual patient. So owner compliance is very, very important before doing cataract surgery, because as cataract surgery may have long-term complications. So there may be chronic uveitis, and as we've heard before, chronic inflammation of the eye may lead to glaucoma or may lead to retinal detachment. So it is important that these patients are regularly monitored to try and prevent these complications. So we do have another question. That's whether or not cataracts can actually come back after the cataract surgery. Now, fortunately, that is not the case, because we do actually remove the cataractous tissue, so that is being cut out of the eye, and we're just leaving behind the lens capsule. And there's probably one exception in very young dogs, so dogs of less than a year of age. There may be some regrowth of cataract material, and it's not unheard of that surgery has been done. It has to be done again, not to the same degree as your initial cataract, but there'll be some globules as le of lens material forming. But any older dogs, so cataract removal will be permanent, and the cataracts will not come back. Okay, so we're just going to have a look at the lens instability. So remember that the lens is kept in place by these zonules. If the zonules lose their strength, either due to a primary weakness of the zonules or due to a disease process inside the eye, the lens is, due to gravity, will be pushed or may fall into the eye and cause damage there. Primary lens luxation is actually a genetic defect in a number of breeds, mainly in terrier breeds, but also the Lancashire Heeler, for example, or the Border Collie, and also within the Sharpei, there's a form of primary lens luxation. In these patients, the zonules break down usually at an age between 3 and 5 years, sometimes later. Very rarely, this condition may be unilateral. And there's by now a DNA test available to test for this condition, and hopefully, the frequency of this will reduce over time now. Now, secondary lens luxation may be caused due to trauma. So, if a blunt trauma is strong enough to disrupt the zonular fibers, lens may also move. In that case, we'll expect other ocular conditions there. So, normally these patients also have retinal detachment or bleeds inside the eye. So, normally quite significant other changes within the eye. Now, chronic inflammation may also destroy the little zonules and lead to a lens luxation, which is not uncommon with chronic cataracts. If a cataract has been there for a long time, causing just very mild but ongoing uveitis, it's possible that the lens may look sad, as you can see here. So we've got the lens in front of the iris, which is a clear sign of an anterior lens luxation. And we've got patients with glaucoma, and the globe is actually stretched, so usually in these eyes are blind by the time they present. As we can see here, so a large eye, the zonular fibers cannot reach the periphery in all areas and start rupturing, and then the lens starts to move inside the eye. But they're normally end-stage glaucoma eyes. So what may the lens do? So if the lens zonules rupture, the eye can either fall into the posterior segment of the eye or it may come into the anterior chamber. And that's really the main concern here, because it blocks the way the fluid moves inside the eye. So that's what happens if we've got the lens in the anterior lens capsule, in the anterior chamber rather, then it will cause some damage to the cornea, leading to a mild opacity, so corneal edema. It also blocks the fluid from exiting the eye through the iridocorneal angle, and the pressure builds up inside the eye, and that will then damage the retina and can lead to blindness. So if the pressure is high enough, or if the pressure is elevated for long enough, that will mean that the patient is starting to lose sight. And the lens, if you remember, or if you just think of many terriers or dog breeds, just shaking their head, so it's also possible that the lens gets thrown around inside the eye and can cause further damage to the intraocular structures. So when we try and look for lens luxation, what should really be warning signs? Ocular discomfort, very unspecific ocular redness as well. However, if you've got a patient with corneal edema, which may be very, very mild, just a light bluish grayish hint here, as well as here, or maybe more pronounced as in this patient. Now you might be able to see the lens in front of the iris, or you might be able to see an aphakic crescent. So here we can actually follow the periphery of the lens. Yeah, and we've got the iris on top here, so there's a gap, so there's an aphakic crescent. And we can also appreciate that this lens is sitting in front of the iris, so it's a very clear sign that we've got a lens in the anterior chamber. The patients usually show visual deficits, either due to the raised intraocular pressure or the opacities in the anterior segment of the eye. And what you may also notice is unusual iris movements, so particularly if the lens is moved into the back of the eye. The lens normally stabilizes the iris, and if the lens moves around, that may mean that the iris flaps around a little bit like a curtain. So what is really important that we diagnose lens luxation early, so the pressure does not build up high enough so that the eye is blinded. Remember that if we've got a patient that presents with that problem in one eye and it's really bad, and we'll decide to remove that eye because it's blind from glaucoma, it's important to know that it's a bilateral disease, so the same thing will happen in the other eye, very, very likely, particularly in younger dogs, and it is important to have a plan for that eye. So what do we do how do we choose what treatment we're going to offer for the patient? So the important questions are, is the eye still visual? Is there glaucoma? Is there any retinal detachment? So if the eye is blind, then obviously the treatment that we'll offer will be different to patients that can still see. So the treatment options that are available are either surgical treatments, that would be removal of the lens either via phacoemulsification, so very much comparable with cataract surgery as we've just discussed, or lensectomy, where we take the lens out in one piece. Alternative treatment is the use of prostaglandin analogues, such as travertan or xalatan. And what they do is they constrict the pupil, and the idea is to try and keep the lens in the back of the eye, where it still does some damage, but not as much as if it goes into the front. Now, that can buy some time, but does not have the best long-term outcome. As we've got patients that can see with that, we'll say about 1,000 days on average, and that will be visual with that medication, but may still develop glaucoma, and the lens may still get into the anterior segment. So the owners, again, need to be very aware of that and need to react very quickly if the eye does change. So this is a patient where the Prostaglandins are used so the pupil is really small and the lens is trapped in the posterior segment. So with a lensectomy, the lens is removed in one piece. Now the lens is a fairly large organ, so you need a fairly large incision, roughly 160 degree. You open up the eye, you remove the lens, clean out the eye, so clean away vitreous and any viscoelastics, and then suture the cornea again. So these eyes will be aphakic. They will be visual but long-sighted. In comparison to that, the phacoemulsification in this case, not as a surgery that I've shown you before, we've got two incisions, one for the instrument, so the phacoemulsification handpiece, and the other for a second instrument that helps to hold that lens that is moving around within the eye. So we've got smaller incisions compared to the lensectomy, so therefore less trauma to the eye, and these patients do have a better long-term outcome. Unfortunately, some dogs already present with a blind eye due to late diagnosis of the condition. Sometimes only when the second eye is starting to lose sight, these patients are presented. For the blind eye, we usually recommend enucleation of the eye. However, if that's a problem for the owner, it is possible to place an intrascleral prosthesis, so emptying out the eye and putting a silicone sphere into that cavity to have something that looks like a normal eye. It is not a normal eye, however, and may still develop complications such as dry eye, for example, or corneal ulcers, and still needs to be looked after very well. So the owners, again, need to be aware of that. Just to come to a closure here for our lens diseases in dogs. So whenever you've got a patient with a penetrating corneal injury, or you would like to examine the lens because the owners are suspicious of a cataract, or you may be suspicious of a cataract, make sure you dilate the pupil so you're able to examine the entire lens. Now it's really important that patients that where a lens trauma is expected, or patients that develop a diabetic or other type of sudden onset cataract, they also should be referred as quickly as possible to allow early assessment and cataract surgery as soon as possible to prevent any complications that may be caused by lens-induced uveitis. And if you do have a patient with corneal edema could potentially be an indication of severe intraocular disease, including lens luxation or glaucoma. But lens luxation is certainly something that always should be expected, and these patients should also be referred for assessment of the intraocular pressure as quickly as possible. Right, are there any further questions? No, excellent. In that case, I just say thank you very much for attending the webinar today. Oh, hang on, we do have a question. So the question that we have is whether or not diabetic cataracts do actually have a higher risk following cataract surgery to develop complications. That's actually not the case as long as the diabetic cataracts are operated early. So if a diabetic cataract is operated before lens-induced uveitis is present, or before the lens capsule is ruptured, then the success rate is just as good as in patients that do not have diabetic cataracts, so in non-diabetic patients. Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you very much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Claudia for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.